Once more, we return to the land of Jaegers versus Kaiju and a direct sequel to Del Toro's original masterpiece. But can a sequel by a television writer and director live up to the original without nearly any of the main cast? Find out on this week's Robo versus Monster Rumble. This is Kaiju versus History, Pacific Rim Uprising.
Welcome back to Kaiju versus History. This is your legacy character getting some more sequel time, Patrick, and joining me is the unnamed son of our killed commander, Miles. Hey, Miles.
What's up, Patrick? Yeah, this is a movie that I have kind of low-key most looked forward to trying since we started this podcast because I actively kind of avoided this movie when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people did.
Well, yeah, I know it didn't do amazing at the box office. I mean, it made $290, I think, but like that was like barely more than its budget. I think it was like $150 to $176.
Probably broke about even. They say factor in about 50% advertising, which isn't involved in the budget, which would put it at about like 280 or so. So right there in the middle.
So you say the unnamed son, but like Jake has a name.
Well, not in the first movie. Like, did he ever mention he had a son in the first film? Pinter?
I don't think so. But like at the same it's the way the movie goes. You can also see, and especially how like Jake talks about his dad, you can also see like, he may not have wanted to mention him.
Well, at the time of the first movie, I think it's implied that he is in training to be a pilot. So maybe he was like very far away from the events of the first film at the time. But yeah, I don't know, because so much is about in the first movie, the father daughter relationship. You would think that
You still get the impression that like Mako Mori is supposed to be a little bit older than him. Like she does have that older sister vibe about her.
Yeah, we get a picture that pops up towards the end of this movie that I want to say puts the age difference in like the 10-year range somewhere in there, which I don't even know how old John Boyega is when he made this movie or how old he's supposed to be playing.
I mean, but he was born in 92, so he wasn't like super old.
No, 92 would be what, 26? Like
20, probably 26. Well, probably 25 when he was filming it.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
this would have been right after Force Awakens, but like and certainly after Attack the Block. But like this would have been like right after Last Jedi, I would assume. Right? This is 2018.
Yeah, so it's kind of in the middle of those, and I was pretty happy to see John Boyega in this film, and you know, rightfully kind of headlining it. But yeah, I think it is supposed to be somewhere in the neighborhood of a 10-year difference between them, which would probably mean that Pendergast had his blood son around the time, or like right after, you know, they found his daughter in the film, if that makes sense, when he found Mako Mori. So, but yeah, just it's funny that just not a plot point at all. And also there's no mention in either of these films of a wife or mother. That's the other thing.
Well, I mean, the kind of movie this is that, I mean, that's forgivable. We don't know anything about any of these characters' home lives in the first movie.
No,
that's fine. I mean, yes, a lot of this is sequelitis, but I did kind of want to, like, kind of before we started talking about everything, I kind of wanted to get the temperature of, like, you know, did you see this movie when it came out? Were you interested when it came out? Because I actively was of the, I'm good. This should have been one and done. And
so, I mean, if Del Toro wanted to make sequels, I would be all for them. I didn't see this in theater, but I'm a librarian in my day job, and I did show this to teens at the library as like a movie afternoon, and they dug it, you know, they enjoyed it for what it was.
I remember because this sequel comes, you know, several years after the first.
Of 5 full years, I think.
Is that yeah, right? And so that doesn't sound like a lot, but like
it is a lot.
But in some ways, it feels like an entire generation happened. Because I remember when this movie was announced, and I was like, "Are they really doing without a tour? Really?" Mm-hmm. And
yeah, and I'm not.
I have to say there were rumors for years that like, "Oh, we want to do this. We want to do this." There was. I remember the conversation with Del Toro. I do remember this. At one point, they're like, "Oh yeah, could we see like the Jaegers go against Godzilla?" And mm-hmm. That was a real conversation that happened.
They said if they were going to do a third movie, they would try to tie it into Legendary, and they really kind of stuck by that. The first Pacific Rim came out in 2013, and this is a full 5 years later in 2018. The movie, though, was greenlit in 2014. So Pacific Rim Uprising
makes sense.
Was greenlit pretty quickly with a targeted release date of 2017. 4 years is still a long time, but yeah, I agree. The 5 year gap felt like, you know, just what's the point? It seems like all the juice from that first movie had already left. And I mean, I don't want to get too much in the production of the film, but I read something online that Guillermo del Toro was like literally minutes away from being able to direct this movie and the other small project that he was working on at the time, which was, of course,
Nightmare Alley.
Shape of Water, which he won the Oscar for.
Oh, right. Because, yeah, this is before. Okay, yeah.
The story goes that he could have done both of them if the studio had been able to rent out these filming locations, these, you know, indoor studio space that was mm-hmm. like nearby where he was filming Shape of Water. Like he was going to like basically do double duty and direct kind of both movies at once. But because they just like didn't get a deposit in on time for this other studio, he had to like step back from doing this, which maybe that's why there was like a year gap between when they wanted to get this out and having to get another director. But the director, which you know, Stephen DeKnight, Stephen S. DeKnight, has done a lot of television. The first season of Marvel's Daredevil he was involved with, I think.
Which, as a recording, the first two episodes of the new season just dropped.
Yeah, writer, director on a lot of those.
Yeah, he was a writer of several Smallville episodes, but most important to me, he was the director and writer of several episodes of Angel.
Angel, Buffy, Dollhouse, another Joss Whedon joint. This is this was and is, I think, still his only film. Is that right?
Yes, this is his only feature. I think he's currently working on the new Spartacus series. He was the OG showrunner and director of, or writer and director and creator of the Spartacus. And then Spartacus was a Blood and Sand or something like that. Mm-hmm. I never watched them.
Arena, it looks like. Now, wow, it's not even...
Yeah, there's Blood and Sand and Gods of the Arena. That was a miniseries. And I guess there's several miniseries. I didn't realize how big the Spartacus like TV world was.
The Spartacus averse.
Right. The Spartaverse.
Yeah.
But before we get further into talking about Pacific Rim Uprising, Patrick, tell us, what's in the title?
Well, you know for a fact, Miles, there's a couple things. Because this movie and like the first one was so widespread, it got translated all over the world, and they did have to change some things because Pacific Rim doesn't translate into other countries where they don't use that phrase, you know, which is one of the reasons I dislike the title Pacific Rim. I'm going to start with the most interesting one. In Lithuania, it translates to Fire Flower Uprising, which is like kind of their translation of Ring of Fire, Fire Flower, which makes a little sense. Sometimes the uprising changed, and, you know, it uprising in Mexico is called Titans of the Pacific Insurrection, which is very similar to uprising. But Titans of the Pacific is also a great title for this film. Battle for the Pacific in Croatia and Serbia. Uzbekistan had Pacific Horror : Riot. I think riot is a funny term for uprising, but
I agree.
Thailand title was Pacific Rim Rise Up, which also works pretty well. Yeah, I don't know. Do you like uprising as a subtitle for this film? It feels kind of lazy.
It really does. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for this movie.
Who's uprising? Who in the movie is uprising, Miles? Name one character.
I guess you could say the precursors, which is the name for the alien beings that we didn't have before.
Didn't they? I thought they mentioned that in the first from movie.
The Pacific. They don't, I don't think.
Huh.
Do they? No, because we when Newt drifts with the brain of the kaiju, like he discovers their existence. We never have any like FaceTime with these little bastards.
Well, the Wikipedia for the first film says that the term precursor was in there somewhere.
Maybe he says that they're precursors to something, but I don't know if that was their actual title.
They are a part of the story, and we get to find out kind of a little bit more about what they were planning with the kaiju, which I'm sorry to say clashes completely with, you know, what we saw in the first movie. Like the plot that they throw out is all the kaiju were trying to get to Mount Fuji, but maybe they should have said to an active volcano.
I think that's the thing, is like they should have specified that there is some.
But the thing
there's
is
some moments
that the kaiju come up through in the first movie, one rift, right? There's only one place of the ocean floor. Or maybe I'm misremembering it. I thought they only came through one location, and that's what when they closed it, it was like permanently gone. But if that's the case, then they would be radiating from that one location to volcanoes, you know, and doesn't seem like they would have to go to the mainland. It's like, hey, there's Hawaii. It's like right there.
You know? Right. I mean, this is a movie that I have known to be hated. Like I've always felt kind of somewhat vindicated in not seeing this movie, because everyone that I know that did see it, like, just absolutely abhorred it. Like I was talking to a buddy of mine when I mentioned that I was checking it out. And I mean, he was just like, I have not hated a sequel more that wasn't like a horror movie sequel in my lifetime. And I was like, why? What did you hate so much? Did they just undermine everything from the first film? And
I don't know about that.
So that's where I was like, well, I'm coming in with fresh eyes. I'm coming in, you know, several years after the fact. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you know, the entire time I'm watching it, I'm kind of giving him my live reactions. And to the point where he was like, you know, maybe I was just not in the right headspace. Maybe I was just being too, you know, in my own thing about it. And
you know what?
I have to say, mm-hmm. like, you know, I came to this movie like with the lowest expectations, because everyone I know spits such like vitriol at this film, where I was just like, OK, this is interesting. And this is frankly kind of fun.
Yeah.
let's get into this movie.
That's
because
the thing.
This movie does not start off with like a big kaiju attack. This movie starts off very differently. And it's so funny watching this now, having like seen and loved Alien Romulus, because, oh, here's our main character.
Yeah. The
Amar Nomani.
I will say just point blank, I think the cast of this movie is better than the first movie. Yeah.
Gangbusters.
And it's not actors. They're just fun. They're having fun.
I will say this about the cast, and we'll get into some of the stuff later, but I really, really wish Ivana Sokno could get cast as something other than a cold-hearted bitch. Like, she plays that in this movie, in The Spy Who Dumped Me, in Star Wars The Acolyte. Like, she always plays, not The Acolyte, she's in Ahsoka. She always plays the same kind of character. It's not her fault. She's being typecast. And if I were her, I'd be signing up for these roles too. And she's so good at it. Like, she has that look to her. But I feel so bad for her, because I think she's a very good actress. And I think in this particular movie, I wish they gave her character more pathos for being the way she is. But it's something that I immediately noticed, like, after the fact, because I mean, I've seen her in so many other things where she plays that character, and I was like, oh, come on.
It's so funny, because I feel like the first Pacific Rim needed to be cut down almost in some ways with some of their supporting cast characters. But this movie, the recruits, maybe on the first viewing, I didn't quite realize, like, they were going to be very important, because I thought this was going to be like, you know.
So this is not your first time watching it?
No. Like I said, I showed it at the library years ago.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You did say that. Yeah.
Probably in 2018 when it came out on DVD. But I think on second viewing, you can like really allow yourself to enjoy the recruits a lot more. And yeah, it's just a different, very different film. It's a very fun film. Del Toro technically produced and read the script, but has said since in interviews he's never been able to bring himself to watch the movie.
I think he says that because he knows this movie's reputation, because it just seems like beneath him to like kind of give that sort of like the type of filmmaker he is, and like the way he represents himself in interviews, he seems not to be the kind of person to like just crap off on someone's work, you know.
Well, he said in an interview, quote, it's like watching home movies from your ex-wife. It is terrible if they're good and worse if they're bad, or the opposite. You don't want to know, so I didn't see it.
I mean, that's valid, but I don't know. I don't know. I feel like talk with them.
Benny,
Guillermo, I know you're a listener to the show. You're free to come on anytime you want to and give us your real opinion.
We're going to have to look at our schedules, but...
You can. If he wants to come to the show, he is absolutely able to come to the show.
You're calling out of work if it's like 3 a.m. or something in the morning.
100%.
Yeah, he. I think with a lot of people is probably scared of some of those reviews, because it said it's got a whopping 42% on the old tomato meter.
Yeah.
The audience score is actually worse than the critic score, which I'm confused, because like I said, I watch this movie, and I mean, there's some problems with it. We're not going to gloss over those, but like, no. I said, the cast is a lot of fun. The story isn't the same. I mean, it is like, kind of like an end of the world. They have to stop the apocalypse again, but
it's so different, which I really appreciated. Different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so let's kind of summarize this plot, because we start off with
10 years in the future,
yeah, 10 years after the fact, the kaiju have not yet come back.
Which is some pretty areas, nice.
Yeah, yeah. I like this idea that like, okay, we kind of won. Jake Pentecost, the son of Idris Elba's character from the Stacker. First film,
I think it was his first name,
is kind of narrating this movie and talking about like in certain areas where the kaiju have fallen and stuff, they'd never rebuilt, and so it is kind of a haven for smuggling and taking old Jaeger parts, and it sets up this movie very nicely.
I hate the intros to both these films. I can't believe they use the same like voiceover.
I love it in the second film, like him parting in a mansion that like they technically don't live at, and like all, like
I just don't think we need the voiceover. Like, just like show us. It's such visually interesting stuff they're doing in the beginning of the movie.
I don't know, because unlike like a Blade Runner or something where I think the voiceover kind of ruins the movie, this is a little bit different as a sequel, because I feel like it gives you the expectation of he's talking about, like, you know, you see him partying at this mansion and everything, and you think, oh, he's the son of each selfless character. He's living it up because of that. And then you kind of pull back and it's like, oh, no, they're partying basically in a carcass of an old kaiju, and they're in the Badlands, essentially. And I thought that was a really fun way to subvert expectations for this character.
It is very... I mean, just the visuals of this movie. I mean, we'll talk about the special effects, which is pretty rough in parts, but it is so bright. The majority of the film, I think, takes place during the day, which is the exact opposite of the first.
Well, it's also responding to a lot of complaints from kaiju films of the age. A lot of people complained about Godzilla and King of the Monsters, which we will get to shortly, but... people complain about that everything's at night or it's during the rain and all of this stuff. And I think this was a direct response to that, of like everything being in the daytime.
Yeah. And I will say, I mean, I guess the idea is you hide some special effects at night, or you hide it in a rainstorm, which, you know, like you said, they did do a lot of in Godzilla King of the Monsters. This looked great. I think the monster effects were, definitely not as good in the first film, but I could see what was going on and it looked fine. You know,
I think the problem with the monster effects in this one is that some of the same issues that I noted in the first film, and that's the kaiju designs aren't amazing. Like they're cool monsters, but they're not that's shown even more. Even though the monsters are better designed, I think in this film, they're still the same breed and it's not as visually interesting as are the robots. You know,
we talked a little bit about that in our Pacific Rim review of like, it kind of stinks that the kaiju look so similar, but there's a story reason for it.
Yeah.
They could like have kaiju for very different things, and that makes them look very different. So they have one that they were planning to send to Alaska, so it's like prepared for the cold there, or they have one that's like a deep sea and that's your leatherback from the first movie and it's like more armored. The three that we get in this film, we technically get more than three, but the three that end up fighting are very similar, but again, there's kind of like a story reason for that. And it was one of my favorite twists of the film when they three fuse together, something that we've seen in other kaiju movies, but you know, did not think would be possible for this series, into a super kaiju, which I enjoyed a great deal.
I did too. It was very Power Rangers, which I appreciate, always will. Let's set up the story a little bit. So Jay Pentecost is kind of living his high life as kind of this outcast. He's kind of a smuggler of kaiju and Jaeger parts. He's also known for ripping people off. He's very much a Han Solo in this Pacific Rim world.
It rubbed off on the actor from Star Wars. He's just like, I'm going to do this in the Pacific Rim film.
And
there's one throwaway line in the very beginning there. It's like, you ripped off Hannibal Chow that one time. I was like, did he? Like, didn't he die like 10 years ago? Like, how long has he been busting, you know?
isn't there like a deleted scene or something where he gets like spit back up or something?
Yeah, but I thought he got ate again after. I forget.
I don't remember. But I dig that. I did. Yeah, he rips these guys off. But to find like the beating heart of a Jaeger, basically the main power source. But to his surprise, someone else has already beat him to it. He actually wasn't planning on fully ripping these guys off, as far as I can tell. And so we get this cool chase sequence. And, you know, obviously that's when we meet. Is it Kaylee Spaney? Is that her name?
Yep. Kaylee Spaney, who's like our mech ingenue in this film. And as you said, she was great in Alien Romulus.
Oh, she's fantastic. And you know, I loved her in this. She plays Namani, who is basically kind of like the mech Aladdin, essentially. She's like a street kid who's built her own Jaeger, but she's built a smaller one so that she doesn't need to actually drift with anyone. She can pilot it by herself. Scrapper is its name, which I love that.
I mean, she doesn't need to drift at all because she has no like headset on when she's piloting it. So it's like, I mean, they do, I think, drift with it at the end of the film, but I just thought it was funny. It's like, yeah, no, you don't need to drift with it at all. You can just like pilot a robot, you know, like a robot.
But as the audience, we don't really know that yet. But Jake says something and she spits back, you know, not this small or whatever. And so we have this chase sequence when is it the Gypsy Avenger that pops in?
It is not. I think it's Bracer.
Oh, it's Bracer Phoenix. Yeah, it is Bracer Phoenix.
Once again, continuing the tradition of great Jaeger names in this film and okay kaiju names. Like, they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, they're fine. Basically, both these two get caught. They get thrown in jail. They're essentially bailed out by Mako Mori. And she was like, yeah, low key, we were kind of scouting both you anyway. We want you to come back as a Ranger cadet and a Ranger, like, I guess, trainer. is what they want.
Sorry. It was there's so many Jaegers in this film. It was November Ajax. was the first like.
That's the fun thing about Amara is like she knows the name and type of every single Jaeger, which is super fun. She's a big like she's kind of like the Kamala Khan of the Pacific Rim universe.
Yeah, and you know she's got a great backstory. She's the one that when the characters drift later, we get to see her. Memories of like losing her family, and it is like you know kind of repetitive as far as like character backstories go, but I mean in a world where like this is like your main thing, you're gonna have lost some parents, you know, you're gonna have, have some kaiju trauma to help you drift. Once again, Del Toro is a genius. It's a great storytelling mechanic. It just seems just one sci-fi idea too far for this already crazy movie. But great mechanic, and she's a great mechanic, speaking of mechanics, who like you said gets inducted into the Pan Pacific Alliance, which you know at the end of the or in the middle of the first movie they were thinking about like shutting down and just building walls. And it's like, how dumb are you guys? You think
we're still kind of back at that. We're like, you know, the Jaeger programs are getting less and less funding. And we now also have this subplot of, well, why do we need pilots when we can use our drone AI?
I love the fact that, well, behind the scenes, Legendary Pictures was like majorly purchased by a Chinese firm between Pacific Rim 1 and 2, which is why there's a large contingent of Chinese actors in this movie speaking Chinese, which, you know, is totally fine. It's, you know, something that probably could have happened in the first movie without much of a eyebrow being raised. But the main character you think is going to be a bad guy is a Chinese tech guru. And she turns out to be the best good guy in the movie,
who saves the day at the end. I absolutely love subverting that trope. Like, because the entire time, so you have this idea that, like, all right, this AI program is being held up to a vote. Mako Mori is the only, is like the main deciding factor. Like, she's going to be the kind of, everyone's kind of down the middle. And she's the deciding factor. She does not want this to happen. Well, all of a sudden, there is a rogue Jaeger in Australia that kind of tears Sydney apart and embarrasses the human Jaeger pilots.
Yeah, there's a lot of, and it should have been in the first movie, but Jaeger on Jaeger action in this film. Technically, it is a kaiju still, but that first fight is great. It's a mech battle, you know?
Yeah, and actually we saw her not too long ago in Kong Skull Island.
Yes, she in the course of like 1 year was in both movies for Legendary Pictures, which is pretty cool.
I think her only two English movies, if I'm not mistaken. Well, no, she did that Great Wall movie with Matt Damon.
You're not going to count
which that. I haven't seen. I've seen scenes from it.
You know where I watched it was, well, I watched clips of it. I went to a live taping of How Did This Get Made? Where they were talking about it. And it is nice. It is a wild film. But
I thought her name's Jing Tian, and she was phenomenal. I really liked her a lot. I liked the story a lot. I love the idea that like they set up for her because they even give you like every kind of like late 80s, early 90s, like Bond-esque like nuance for her to be the villain. And the fact that she isn't is so refreshing to me.
Well, and it is quite a big surprise because our actual villain is one of only a few returning characters from the first film in Charlie Day's Dr. Newton. And it's a shame, but like they explain his drifting with the kaiju brain in the first movie has basically allowed the kaiju to take over and turned him into kind of a supervillain of sorts, you know, and it allows them. He like genetically reverse engineers kaiju tech in our world and infects all the drones to reopen the portals to the precursor dimension. It's a pretty cool. It's very comic book plot. You know,
it is. I want to talk about that for a second because this is one of those things where, like, when it first is introduced, I kind of actively hated it. And a lot of people, I know a lot of people, like, this was their sticking point.
Yeah.
I honestly think it's great, but because that whole storyline is so undercooked, it feels like it almost feels like a shock value choice. And
it just feels like there's so many red herrings before we get to that turn, which is like halfway through the movie.
There's that, but like they don't really give us. And I mean, I don't want you to like have to like put breadcrumbs so that I figured it out early. It's not that. It's just I feel that whole story is just it doesn't really work for me. Mm-hmm. I like the choice. I don't like how it was executed, if that makes sense.
I kind of wish they had signaled a little earlier on that the dark Jaeger was a kaiju, because it fights very much like human pilots, you know.
Yes.
And I mean, to my knowledge, it was just a kaiju brain. Like, I don't think it was also Charlie Day piloting that mech.
I assume it was connected to the quote unquote Alice.
Yeah, maybe, but maybe it's just like a clone of Alice. Again,
that whole thing was so undercooked. And like,
I just wished it had been more animalistic.
Even when he connects with the brain when he comes home from work that one day, like, it didn't even like occur to me that was a negative thing. Cause I was like, well, I've seen that he's done that before. You know,
I mean, I don't think it's like, oh, he's evil because he's in love with.
Yeah,
I thought it was just super weird.
Yeah, it's just weird. It almost is like, oh, he's like, honestly, I thought it was like kind of getting high at the end of the day. That was the vibe I got from it. So I was just like,
yeah. The thing is, Charlie Day is just way too charismatic. You know,
right?
You want to believe he's a good guy till the end.
You don't want Charlie Day to be the bad guy anyway. And even when he is the bad guy, he's the bad guy. Like, he still feels like Charlie from Sunny, but like at a certain level. Like the episode where he and Mac are at that fancy restaurant, they're staring at each other from across the room. Like, that's his vibe for most of this movie.
Yeah. And then his very heterosexual scientist partner, Vern Gorman. Is also in this film, and
who is such a great actor. I love him so much.
Amazing. I've not seen anything he's been in that's not been just like a tour de force.
One of his really great characters. Understated performances. You should watch the psychological thriller Watcher by Chloe Okuno, who was, I think, is supposed to, or was doing some sort of Dracula type of movie. But this is a psychological thriller film with Micah Monroe, and I think it's on the Shutter right now. It's fantastic, and he is phenomenal in it. But yeah, I love Vern Gorman. I think he's fantastic.
He had a real small role in Beetlejuice, but
does he?
It's so funny. Oh man, have you still not seen that?
I still haven't seen it.
It's great. He plays the town priest.
He plays Charles Bloodhorn in The Offer, which is the biopic on the making of The Godfather on Paramount Plus, which I've watched like probably three times all the way through.
Oh man. Yeah.
He's so good. And he's great in this. Like, I love, like, as undercooked as the Newt story is, I think the Herman aspect is,
they're both given helps. A good amount of screen time, and they are, you know, for the most part, are comic relief, even though John Boyega is very comedic in this film. But the one thing that
his like chemistry with Kaylee Spani is so good. Yes. In like a little brother, a little sister, big brother way.
The movie really should have just focused on them, because we also have, you know, his ex-partner, Nate, played by Scott Eastwood. He's perfectly fine. But then they also add in a love interest that it goes nowhere. She just kisses both of the guys on the cheek at one point.
Legit. And this movie loses an entire point because of that tacked on love triangle. I'm not a big love triangle fan, but like, that thing was the most like pandering BS I have seen in quite some time.
Cut that scene. It's not needed. You know what this needed is more of John Boyega and Kaylee Spani, because the movie ends with them having a snowball fight, and it's the most adorable thing ever. Yes. And it's what I think the first film needed was a little bit
the first ending of this movie.
Right. But it was great. It was a great ending. Like, you know, 30 seconds prior, they were ready to die together. And then she's like, oh, wow, I've never seen snow before. It's like, oh, yeah, you grew up on the beach.
I love this. I think the weird thing about this movie is it feels like a 100-minute condensing of a season of excellent television.
Because I would have liked more.
If we had gotten more time of all the, I loved all the trainees. I loved every single one of them. And like the time we get with Amara and everyone else, like I know I said something about us, Asakno, like at the same time, like I think it's absolutely lazy that you have the kind of the typical asshole bully trope for no reason, especially since we get zero payoff for that whatsoever. But I thought everyone was great. I love like every time they did something with the group and we saw these kids, like I'll give this to the writers, like contextually they made it seem like these kids were like kind of coming together and growing up together in the little screen time that we got. I thought that was fantastic. Like I would have loved seeing like some entire parts of hour-long episodes dedicated to Amara's training with these ranger trainees. I think that aspect was fantastic. One of the strongest parts of the movie, to be honest. But yeah, I gotta say,
I really wish that's what they had gone with the black, because after seeing this, we'll talk about the black. I still have not watched it.
Okay, so I watched the first season when it came out, so we'll get to it when we talk about it, because I did love the black. The cool twist to me, and I recontextualized it to my buddy who did not like this movie initially, and I was like, well, did you think about it this way? When there's a moment where all the drone-controlled Jaegers from the Shao Corporation, which is the corporation that Newt's been working for and is the Chinese like consortium that is like kind of pitching these AI controlled, or not AI specifically, but like remote controlled drones.
So yeah, it's half AI and it requires just one human pilot per Jaeger.
Which that pilot seemed like they were not equipped for the job.
Yeah.
But so when the AI gets infected by the kaiju and all of a sudden they do this Evangelion style hybrid mode.
For real.
And it's gorgeous. Like, I mean, and I was like, rewatch the sequence when the first Jaeger kind of gets infected with the kaiju and like they do the exact kind of berserker motions. This was 100% made by someone who loves Evangelion. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a cool touch.
Yeah, I wish we had been able to have like a full Jaeger versus infected Jaeger fight, because I feel like there's some cool stuff you could do with that. Like, I don't know, chop off an arm and they just like reattach it or something. Mm-hmm. Like
that. Yeah.
But yeah.
And that's the only anime reference in this movie. I don't know if you caught this or not.
Mm-hmm.
The one? Gundam statue's there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very fun, because that's the other thing. I love, boy, howdy, do I love the final battle in this movie. It takes place in Tokyo, which happens to be right next to Mount Fuji in this universe. It's a different universe where they're next to each other. Like, you can see Tokyo from Mount Fuji. But yeah, it's in full daylight. It is in downtown Tokyo, and one of their escape pods lands right in front of a Gundam statue, and I don't think I noticed it on the first watch through, but this time I was like, oh, look, they're
oh, it was, I clocked that immediately. In fact, I had like, in case you hadn't seen it, I like screen grabbed it, and I was just like so thrilled about that, because obviously I want to see a Gundam fighting some kaiju. Like, that's all I want. And you know, haven't really gotten that. The final battle is fantastic. There is a sequence where they kind of go to the upper atmosphere, and until they had communicated that there is like an invisible, like sci-fi, like barrier in their visors that we don't see. I was like, why are they conscious?
Yes. Yeah. They show it like popping on and off, but then it kind of like melts away when they are. I don't know if you caught this, because it's like a blink and you miss it thing. When they're trying to ID the image that Mako Mori sent of like supposedly a kaiju head that turns out to actually be an island, they go through like a database of kaiju they made artistic representations of like almost all of the Gamera villains and a couple of Godzilla ones. But like all the Showa era Gamera are represented in these like little diagram.
We mentioned this in Pacific Rim because like there's a lot of Gamera love in them kaiju designs.
Yeah, well they say the sword head one is not a reference to Gairon, but
then like, someone's lying to cover their hiney.
Yeah, well exactly. But yeah, I enjoy that. There's a lot of fun references to kaiju and mech stuff in this movie. What I don't like is they bring up like three times the speech that Stacker Pendergast makes at the end of the first Pacific Rim. It's like, all right, first of all, like there's only like 30 people around him like when he made that speech, and it's like, how is it that
I'm famous? Sure, it was being recorded though.
Okay, yeah, sure. But it's like the first thing Charlie Day says when he meets John Boyega, and they joke about John Boyega making a speech twice, and he does before they go off, and
he makes
like
a great speech too.
Hey, it's fine, but it's
I liked it. I thought it was pretty good.
It's just it's too much. It's like obviously that was like
so was the first one.
Well, no, I think they had to do it because
the difference is it's being made by like Idris Elba, who could like read the phone book and I'd be captivated.
Well, the problem is it was a, you know, a quote unquote viral moment from that first movie, and trying even getting close to it. I think they were going to make a joke out of it, they should have been like, you know, John Boyega, you need to make a speech before we go out there. And he's like, all right, let's do this. And that would have been the end of it. But yeah, I don't know.
That would actually have been very funny if they cut away. I'm like, God, that was such a rousing speech. Like, that we never see the speech. And like that would have been funny.
People are wiping tears away and cheering.
I liked the mini reference to the canceling the apocalypse because it's such a great line. It's such a funny thing to do. And I like that he doesn't go that route. I like he goes the kind of like we are a found family kind of situation, which again, if it was a, you know, a 10-hour, you know, series, like mini series, and we got to see these people like really come together, grow together, and see their relationships like develop, I think it would have hit harder. I think I do think the speech is good. I think John Boyega is fantastic in this movie. Well, but I wish that we had seen more of what he's talking about within the movie.
And
that's the big weakness, but like the big problem with this movie for me is like the characters are there, they're written, but they don't have the moments.
Like we do have one of the kids die in the attack, and it's like almost a blink and you miss it kind of moment. Suresh, who, I mean, they're all kind of given like three or four lines of backstory at most, and then that's it. But
yeah,
it is a bummer when he dies. And but yeah, their teamwork in that final battle, and them like coming together. And I think it is real.
Do you think they had the script for this movie when Atlantic Rim 2 was made? Because
no,
I got that vibe.
That's pretty funny. No, but I, like I said, I really enjoyed that final battle. It feels like almost all the beats of it were pretty well earned. I love Kaylee Spanny's mech going down and then her running to replace Nate in danger. I think it's just Avenger. Oh yes, Avenger in this one, because I don't know if they describe it, like it was already an old mech in like the first movie, right? And now it's 10 years older. But yeah, I liked the mech design in this. I think the orange one,
I think it's slightly better. Yeah. I just, even with the last, even like the last one, I wish there was more definition. Like they all have kind of a bland design. Like if Gypsy Danger or Gypsy Avenger was the only one that looked like that, I'd have been fine. But like they gave this illusion of like, oh yeah, this Russian one's like kind of more of a brawler in the first one. And like it's red, haha. But like it's not, it just still doesn't, I wish it looked more different, you know?
I really enjoyed Saber Athena, which, you know, talk about Evangelion references. I feel like that's a Eva 2 or, you know, what's her name kind of reference.
Asuka?
In her mech.
Oh God. Yeah.
She had like a kind of dual short swords, energy swords in this film, that mech, and they came together as one. It's pretty cool stuff. prequel mechs. Kaiju were, you know, fine. But like I said, I think the was known as the mega kaiju or hybrid kaiju was just a very cool, did not see that kind of coming ending.
Before we start talking about our final thoughts and our rankings for this movie, I do want to talk about the one thing I actively hated and I thought was extremely lazy storytelling. Mm-hmm. I actively hate that they just flat out kill Maka Mori with very little circumstance.
I mean, it's like the same thing in, spoiler warning, some legacy characters in the MonsterVerse series get killed. No,
this felt more like, it just felt so throwaway. And I hate that because this character's already get, I mean, if to me, it felt like watching, you know, Kevin Costner die in Man of Steel. It felt like watching Han Solo die in The Force Awakens.
She was pretty passive because she was literally a passenger in a helicopter. Like if she was like,
yep, this is happening.
If she was like actively, I mean, she was trying to send out a data packet, but if she was like,
yeah, but like
involved in the fight, maybe. But.
Yeah, I didn't need her to be involved in the fight, but like this character would not have been that passive. She wouldn't have done the like, oh, something's happening and turning towards the camera. Like that's not the character. I understand that a lot changed in 10 years.
Yeah, no,
but
no,
still,
she would have kicked that door open and just jumped out of the helicopter.
Right. It just, it just doesn't work for me. I think it's extremely lazy. Like if they had someone like, if the mech had grabbed the helicopter and like fucking slammed it on the ground, I'll retake that. If
like, yeah, shut up, Miles.
No, if you know if the AI controlled Jaeger had grabbed the helicopter and slammed on the ground, or something actively had happened, like I could accept that more. But this big like the missile is coming and I'm not going to do anything about it just does not seem in line with that character at all. And well, I don't know. It just did not work for me.
The other thing, like I said, I kind of wish it was more kaiju like. That mech, because it's like, was it actively trying to kill her? Like, why was it going after this helicopter, you know?
So I feel like it was, I don't know, because like it felt like it was doing it for audience expectations so that we thought that Shao was the villain, because
it seemed like
other side of it is
big red herring, you know?
Yeah, but it's only done for plot reasons, not for like evil plan reasons.
Well, that's the thing. When I first saw this movie, I thought it was going to be kind of like corporate espionage, and like that was going to be a quote unquote rival Jaeger that actually turns into a good guy at the end because of whatever reason. But nope, just turns out it was a kaiju brain. So I mean, yeah,
this ain't Robot Jocks.
so many expectations being subverted. Let's talk about our rating. Like we already talked about how this film did in both box office and reviews. But yeah, I am here to say the reviews are way too harsh on this. I had a blast. It's a perfectly fun film. It is a totally different vibe, I feel like, the first one. And I think it delivers on a lot of things that the first movie was lacking, but it lacks a lot of the obvious director's strengths that you got with the first film. So a bit of a step down from Del Toro's vision. But as far as like an action kaiju slash mech movie, it's great. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10 for personal enjoyment. Mm. Oh, what about you, Miles?
Look, we've talked about like all the problems that we have with this movie, and they do exist, but they don't. There's one thing that they don't really stack up to, and that's the fact that this movie is so much fun from start to end. No matter what plot problems I had, no matter what I wish they had done, I was having a blast with this movie. Yeah. I think every actor, you know, warranted or not, brings the best they can do. I thought Kaylee Spani and John Boyega were fantastic. Their chemistry is incredible. Anytime Bryn Gorman's on the screen is a lot of fun. Charlie Day was honestly really fun as the villain. He's very, very good. I really wish we could have seen more of Rigo Kikuchi. But Jing Tian was great. I would have liked more pathos from her character and got more. Again, I wish this was like a 10 episode series. I think that the problem with some of these big projects these days is they're written in a way that feels like someone took a season of or a miniseries of television and shrunk it down. And that's not really the way to write a movie. That said, it doesn't matter because everything is so much fun. I mean, this movie is a blast. And I like how they took this world 10 years later and made a really fun way to bring all this together. And if I'm going based off my personal enjoyment, I'm giving this a 9 out of 10. I had an absolute ball with this movie.
Yeah, I was close. Honestly, I was right there on the fence. I think it is. It also just moves a little bit faster than the first film.
Mm-hmm. It's paced pretty quickly.
They're both so much fun. But yeah, this one is just fun in different ways. There also was so much world building they had to do in the first film that this could just like kind of assume that mm-hmm. you knew the basics of. So they didn't spend too much time on it. And that brings us to our technical score, you know, from the acting, directing, and some special effects in this movie, it is a little bit of a letdown after the first film. Special effects wise, a lot of the stuff when they're outside the Pan Pacific Jaeger base, it's just really weird blue screen or green screen that just does not look good. But it's so funny. All the CGI mech stuff looks great, though. You mm-hmm. know, it's such a crazy difference between those two scenes. It's like you'd think the humans would look better, but that's one thing. Del Toro was just all about practical sets for the actors to exist in, where they basically spent millions and millions of dollars on the Jaeger interiors to, like, you know, rock those actors' worlds. But yeah, I would say technically this movie is still, it's not great, but it is very, very good. And yeah, I feel like this, besides the CGI, great action sequences in this movie, I would say rival the first film. And I think some characters fall a little bit short of, but just because they have more time to be fleshed out in the first film. Like you said, I would want a whole bunch more if they're going to have a supporting cast of like 10 kids or whatever, more of them in this film. But I enjoyed the little we got from the cadets more than mm-hmm. the other Jaeger pilots that we got in the first film, which was just like, you know, it's like, why are you here? Just be like adversarial. Yeah, and
absolutely.
It seemed like it was that's something that could have been cut from the first movie. So I'm giving this a 7 out of 10. What about you for the technical score?
So, you know what? I'm kind of in line with you because, you know, I said the love triangle, awful. A lot of the undercutting, not undercutting, but like the lack of focus on the Ranger cadets, I think, really makes this movie feel a little undercooked. The biggest weakness this movie has is its script. While I do agree some of the green screen stuff doesn't work as well, there are so many fantastic action sequences. Some of the designs are better than they were in the first. I think the actual plot is pretty solid, and the acting is really, really solid as well. Mm-hmm. But this script is, it's I don't want to say it's really weak, but like it does a disservice to its characters and its world. Like, I think the basic plot is there, but like you cannot. And I mean, honestly, bringing this even to like a current movie like Star Trek Section 31, you cannot bring this half-baked idea that would work for a season of television and put it into a 100-minute movie and expect it to like just be gangbusters. Like, no matter mm-hmm. how many great ingredients you have, if you don't have a cohesive feature film, which I'm not convinced that this movie does in terms of its script, mm-hmm. You are missing a huge opportunity. And I think that's my biggest problem, is this doesn't feel like a real movie script. It feels like a spec script for a show. That well, said, everything else is.
I was about to say the director has done so many shows, but he didn't write this.
Like, I know the director has, but the director did not write this movie.
No, this was another, like, several people did
well, and actually on one of the people who wrote this movie wrote like one of my least actually wrote the worst Jurassic Park movie, which
the last one
is awful. It's abysmal. That said, I think so much of this movie does work. I think the script is at least competent enough despite all of my misgivings with it. I'm right there with you. A 7 out of 10 seems fair because there's a lot of great stuff here that's undercut by a lot of bad plotting and writing.
What about it's important as a kaiju movie? And it seems like a lot of audiences didn't really respond to this one.
You know what? I think this is like, no matter what I said about the script itself, I think as a sequel and as an idea of what to do, like say you make a great first movie, where do you go? I think this is a really good option. I think this is something you can point to and like, hey, no matter what you think about the movie, the idea they went with that isn't just carbon copying the first movie. It's not just like, oh, there's a brand new kaiju. You have to fight it. There is a cool reasoning as to what's going on here, and there's a lot of political intrigue. A better writer would have made a absolute crackerjack movie. I'm going to give this an 8. I think it takes lessons from kaiju movies, and I'm clearly it's informed by prior kaiju projects, or at least Japanese anime projects. And it does something slightly different, and I think that is something that's really interesting to look at. Now, the movie may not always succeed on those levels, but I do think it is important to point at this movie and be like, hey, this did something a little bit different than everyone else is doing, and maybe we can learn from that. And that to me is a huge, huge point in this movie's favor. What about you?
I did give this another point. I'm going with a 7 out of 10. The first movie, it's hard to compare it because the first movie is so fresh and vital, and it's so crazy, you know. To have a new IP, like a brand new IP, even if it is very pastiche of other ones in this space by, you know, a very soon after this Academy Award winning director. It's so crazy that this movie happened at all without him, first off. But I feel like the first one was just so needed for the kaiju scene and inspired a whole bunch of other stuff. It's hard to follow up to the first Pacific Rim. Even if it did have also its kind of mixed reviews when it came out. But this is a very fine film. I feel like it would have done much, much, much better if it had come out like 3 or even 4 years after the first movie, or later, if it had waited like 10 years and then like you have a nostalgia thing kick in, and instead of a sequel, it feels more like a reboot. And I think maybe a little bit more time to cook would have done well for the series. But that's what the animated show kind of did, because that was when did that come out? 2020?
I think so.
Or even later. It's like 2021. So that was almost 10 years after the first movie. But yeah, it's about Del Toro helming it. It seemed like it should be much less important. But I kind of agree with you. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10. For its importance, I think people should be watching this. It is probably more of a mech movie than a kaiju film, but
what we said about the first one too.
It is both, and it's fine that it's both. And there's just so many cool sci-fi ideas in general in the series. I will say that the first movie made me really want to see a sequel. And we got it. And this movie, I have not watched Pacific Rim the Black. And it makes me want to go watch that show like immediately. I was like, oh, thank goodness. There's a little bit more Pacific Rim. And you said you already enjoyed it. So, yeah. So that
you don't have to wait too long.
Yeah. That gives you your final scores an 8 out of 10. And I'm a 7.3. And our final score, we're rounding up. It's an 8 out of 10. Surprising me.
I'm happy with that. This is exactly where I wanted it to land. So I'm good. I think this movie is drastically overhated.
I knew it had bad reviews. I did not believe it. It was more disliked by the audience. That's crazy to me.
This is one of those situations where I'm like, I know you and I know your taste. And I was like, I feel like we were both kind of on the same thing. So I remember we both loved Chappie, which a lot of people really hated. And
I that's the first time in my entire life I've written a nasty letter to a reviewer.
I know this
about
you.
Dare you give like a Chappie a 0 out of 4 stars? What in the heck is wrong with you? Yeah, love me some Chappie. I'll go to bat for Chappie. I don't know if I'm going to bat for this movie, but 8 out of 10 on our scale puts it in a pretty high category, even though hilariously we've given like, oh gosh, I'm just looking at this season, we've given like 7 or 8 out of 10s already in the 2010s.
Well, yeah, but the 2010s has like legendary movies. So I'm like, I'm not good ones.
Yeah.
Bad about this.
Well, just in the last, when did these come out? In February and March, 4 films had an 8 out of 10 back to back. It was Outer Man, Colossal, Kaiju Mono, and Shin Godzilla, surprisingly, 8 out of 10.
Yeah, well, you look at those movies and yeah, of course they did.
But yeah, I mean,
are you saying that our man Minoru Kawasaki does not deserve some 8 out of 10s?
No, but I, like I said, I'm as surprised as you because of the reputation of this film. But yeah, that'll do it for us. So that's an 8 out of 10. You can follow us on our social media, which is Blue Sky, or go to our website or email us. All that is Kaiju versus History. We're Kaiju versus History at Gmail. If you want to email us in, you can rate and review and comment on our show wherever you find those. We have a Letterboxd account under Kaiju versus History where you can see our reviews in 5-star format. Or if you want to talk to us on Discord, we're in a gaming podcast together called Cosmic Crit. There's a whole sub channel for this podcast, but also anything Kaiju related that comes up. And there's a good amount of news that comes up.
Oh yeah. From just posted these Superman versus Godzilla figures today.
it's a cool collab. The McFarlane, having both of them. Yeah, in
they look great. They really do.
Good idea. Right. Miles, what are we doing next week?
Well, thank you, Patrick. And thank you, listeners. And we're going to catch you next week when we take a second bite at Hollywood this month, trying its hand at the monster movie scene. This time taking an IP from the realm of video games and trying to make it work on the silver screen yet again. But will this film's Animal Kaiju be a hit, or are we about to hit rock bottom with The Rock? Find out alongside us for History versus Rampage.